Well, brethren, it's no secret. You've probably heard characterized in one way or shape or fashion on multiple medias that are indeed available for all of us to peruse, whether it's on the internet, television, radio, you name it, in those areas, that this election that we are going into is probably the most important election in the history of the United States. And I tend to agree with that, putting all hyperbole aside. And I know that people have a way of exaggerating things because, obviously, in some cases, the drama attracts more attention, hoping to maybe even perhaps increase the involvement of those that are listening to it. But in due respect to that characterization, it's not far off, if not right on the button. And the reason I say this, and for all of us to recognize and to really understand, is that the United States of America has now moved into a precipice where there are two obvious conflicting ideologies. And if you don't recognize these conflicting ideologies, man, you've got to get another cup of coffee or something, because the ideologies are clear. They are clear. Brethren, we have on one side of the aisle a globalist, Marxist, globalist policy regime waiting to be elected by the American people. On the other hand, you have a nationalist president looking to be re-elected. Now, don't jump off the cliff and say that I'm going to favor one or the other. I'm just laying this out for observation so that you and I can begin to understand the reality that we are indeed facing is unlike anything we've ever been faced with as the nation of the United States of America. And if that wasn't bad enough, what's complicating it, what is compounding this precipice that we are on the edge, where we are basically the people wanting to make a decision, should I jump or shouldn't I? And you know what's complicating it? The demonic influences that have infiltrated the hearts and the minds of our current leaders. And they are demonic influences by virtue of what some of these who are running our country have been associated with in terms of deeds and doings and dealings, and of which they've been dealing with, which are very important points to keep in mind. And we are, in lieu of some of this corruption, also in that category on a precipice of potentially, and I'm underlying that, potentially being exposed to some of the most gruesome, unconscionable deeds against other people, of which some of our leaders have already been indicted and some have been convicted, while others have been perhaps accused or suspected of certain ugly things that are too ugly to even mention here, but of which potentially, because they have not been convicted or indicted on any of these things. A lot of this still resides in the shadows of conspiracy garb, of circumstantial evidence, of talk and or rap or rumor mongering. Whether or not it will come out of those shadows into the light remains to be seen. But I state all this only to add this element of consideration in knowing full well that this demonic influence and the infiltration of that influence is real. And it is ingrained and embedded in some of the lifestyles of those running the United States of America. And it's a shame. It's no wonder, brethren, because of the corruption that has seeped in, that our political forefather, John Adams, said this. I've got a good memory, but I'll read this. It's short, so I'll read it off the paper here. John Adams said, "Our Constitution was made for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other." Why do you think he said that? Why do you think he recognized, of all things, that it was for a moral and religious people? Well, I'll tell you why. The United States of America is unlike any other nation in the history of the world. There has never been a United States of America predicated on the documents that we are predicated on as a country, which has provided a means, a platform, by which leaders who do get elected by the people enter into a brotherhood that is dealing with trust. Because once you get in to the office of whatever you've been elected into, it opens up an array of access to assets like no other human being has access to. What am I talking about? I'm talking about season tickets for the Washington Senators. I'm talking about free trips and golfing here and there, overnight stays in some of the greatest resort areas that you could imagine, and maybe even a little business dealing on the side, that now that I am who I am in the role that I'm in, leverages my personality and or access of office to whatever for the enrichment of at least myself, if not for my colleagues or colleague or my family or whoever. And so John Adams recognized this. That's why he said, "We're entrusting you as an elected official, as trustee of our government and assets of what it represents and has to offer to the people, we need to trust you. You got to have moral character. You got to be able not to be bribed. You got to be able not to extort. You've got to be able not to involve yourself in sedition or treason and betray the country for the benefit of yourself, or you, your family, or whoever it may be." John Adams recognized this, brethren. And that's why he emphasized this nation, the United States of America, predicated on the documents of the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, the Federalist Papers. It's unlike any nation in the history of the world. Do you know that even Israel wasn't set up like the United States of America? Israel, in the beginning, after they got out of the wilderness, went into the basically promised land and entered into and commenced about 300 to 400 years of the time of the judges. What was that all about? That was about everybody doing what they thought was right in their own heads. And what was your food may have been my poison. So you stay in your lane. I'll stay in mine. At that time, the Bible says there in Judges that in that time there was no king. No king in Israel. Zero. Everybody did that which was right in their own eyes. You can read that, the last verse, the book of Judges. I won't turn there for the sake of time. So then what happened? They went into a monarchy. Israel went into a monarchy. You know what that means? That means a king. The United States doesn't have a king, even though some people may mock and snide, make remarks, and get sarcastic and so forth that, oh, it was King Reagan, or it was King Nixon, or it was King Obama, or it's King Trump. That doesn't fly. That's just rhetoric. The fact of it is, the United States of America has no king. It has three major fulcrums of management. And consequently, those three major fulcrums are checks and balances of each one so that neither one of the three goes off the rails, or at least too far. Today, they are off the rails, and we've got lockup. We've got just two loggerheads. The legislative branch just can't seem to work with the administrative branch at all, and it's gotten worse and worse and worse as we've gone down the line. But Israel was not like the United States. This is what I'm telling you, brethren. We've got something here in this country that is so unique. Dare I say, it's providential. It's providential. It's God-given. Saul was picked by the people. If you want, and I'm already there just for the sake of time. I'm going to turn to 1 Samuel 8, 4 through 7. I want to lay down a premise here that we're going to revisit next week because I'm not going to finish this presentation. This is just the introduction. Next week, I'll finish it. Next week will be a little bit more deeper under the layers of this onion skin that we're just beginning to uncover. But in 1 Samuel 8, I want to lay down a premise here, brethren, that regarding Samuel and the people, verse 4, I'm just going to cut to the chase. Chapter 8, 1 Samuel, verse 4. And all the elders of Israel gathered themselves together and came to Samuel unto Ramah. And the reason they did is because Samuel's kids were no good. They were corrupt, immoral, couldn't be trusted. They were fed up with Samuel, his kids. And there didn't seem to be anybody behind him. So the people, the elders came to Samuel and said, here, behold, you're old, Samuel. Your sons walk not in your ways. Now make us a king to judge us like all nations. The thing displeased Samuel, displeased him, it upset him. When they said, give us a king to judge us. And Samuel prayed to the Lord, and the Lord said to Samuel, stand down, this is my will. Don't do nothing. I got this. Is that what the Lord said? No. The Lord said to Samuel, hearken to the voice of the people. Let their voice be heard. I gave a sermon a couple of weeks back on that title. Let the voice of the people in all that they say unto you, for they have not rejected you, Samuel. The people, by doing what they did, have rejected me. So Samuel, don't take it personal. Relax. The people have rejected me. Who? The people. And so what commenced thereafter was king after king after king. And Israel, 12 tribes united, making a nation of 12 tribes coalesced, the United Tribes of Israel. If I can use that term. The United Tribes of Israel lasted under the reign of Saul, under the reign of David, under the reign of Solomon. Between David and Solomon, 80 years of affluence, semi-peace. They had allies in the area keeping the Assyrians away because Israel was quite a player in the region at that time in the 8th centuries and so forth. So they were actually able to defend themselves, and the Assyrians didn't want to mess with them because they knew they'd get a bloody nose, you know, figuratively speaking, in doing so. So they stayed away from them because Israel was strong. They were all united. Under David and Solomon, all 12 tribes were united. But then, Solomon got wasted and got his eyes on women and went off the rails, garnering a whole corral of wives and concubines from all different types of ethnicities, outside of Israel included, Ammonites and Moabites and, you know, Hittites and all kinds of ites. And as a result of this, his heart, as we're told here in 1 Kings, and I'll turn your attention over here to 1 Kings real quickly. 1 Kings chapter 11, in this case, I'm not going to read from 11 other than to give you some background here. In verses 1 through about 7, 8, and 9, you'll see how basically Solomon went off the rails and marrying all kinds of ladies and got himself distracted. And in verse 6, Solomon, this is chapter 11 of 1 Kings, verse 6, chapter 11, verse 6, Solomon did evil in the sight of the Lord and went not fully after the Lord, as did David his father. Then did Solomon build high places for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab. This was a god in the hill that is before Jerusalem, and for Molech, the abomination of the children of Ammon. So you can see he went really off the rails. In verse 9, the Lord was angry with Solomon. Real simple. What are you doing, Solomon? So one thing led to another. And as a result, we begin to see that there is some real stirring going on, and a war, and the situation here in chapter 11 that is portrayed is a very tense situation where Israel is being faced with invasion and war and so forth. And up comes out of the blue a fella named Jeroboam over in verse 28, chapter 11, 1 Kings 11, verse 28. I read, "A man Jeroboam, a mighty man of valor, and Solomon seeing this young man, that he was industrious, he made him a ruler over the charge of the house of Joseph, which included Ephraim and Manasseh." Jeroboam was a warrior, brethren. He was a warrior, a tough dude. He really was. And he took a lot of responsibility on behalf of Solomon. Solomon liked him. "This is my man. I like him. He's a good guy." However, we have a prophet that enters the story here, Ahijah. And all of a sudden, Ahijah says here in verse 30, he goes through this little scenario, basically a riddle, not a riddle, an event that portrays that essentially at some point Jeroboam is going to take 10 of the 12 tribes and split the nation, leaving only two in the south, Judah and Benjamin. Solomon gets wind of it, and I'll just cut to the chase and kind of summarize the story, and essentially goes after him, and he takes off to Egypt and exiles himself for a while until Solomon dies, and Rehoboam, Solomon's son, takes the throne. Israel's still 12 tribes. Jeroboam gets wind that Solomon, Rehoboam's dad, died. So we pick the story up here, chapter 12, 1 Kings. Rehoboam went to Shechem, for all Israel were come to Shechem to make him king. And it came to pass that when Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who was yet in Egypt, heard, for he was fled there in presence of King Solomon, Jeroboam dwelt in Egypt. that they went or sent and called for him, Jeroboam. And all the congregation of Israel came and spoke to Rehoboam, saying, look, your dad was really hellacious on taxes. He was burdening us on all kinds of things with all these monuments he was building, and it was heavy on us. Give us some tax relief. Sound familiar? We want some freedom. We want some liberty here. Verse 4, the father made our yoke grievous. So the people spoke up on behalf, and Jeroboam was their mouthpiece. And your father and his heavy yoke, which he put upon us, and he said unto them, depart for 3 days, and I'll take it under consideration. And Rehoboam met with the elders of Israel. Remember, this is still, all 12 tribes are still united. All 12 tribes are still united. However, verse 8, Rehoboam came back and he said, not happening. As a matter of fact, you think your taxes were bad? You think your taxes are bad now? Wait till I get in office. You haven't seen anything yet. I'm going to raise them taxes. I'm going to make the burden of my father look like romper room, essentially is what he's saying here. And he goes on, I will add, verse 11, and this is what Rehoboam said. Now, whereas my father did lay on you heavy yoke, I'm going to add to your yoke. My father chastised you with whips. I'm going to chastise you with scorpions. This Rehoboam was a real character. So Jeroboam, being the guy that he was, a mighty warrior with valor, and all the people came to Rehoboam the third day as the king appointed, and the king answered the people roughly and forsook the old man's counsel and they gave him and spoke to them after the counsel of the young men, which were the counterpoints that Rehoboam was counseling with. Verse 15, the result, wherefore the king hearkened not unto the people, for the cause was from the Lord, that he might perform his saying which the Lord spoke by Ahijah, the prophet. This came from the Lord. The people went to the king rejected the counsel, but Ahijah said a prophecy was going to happen. Jeroboam was going to be the man that was going to receive it, and this is why we're told it came from the Lord. So when all Israel, verse 16, saw the king hearken not unto them, the people answered the king, saying, what portion do we have with David? We don't. We don't have a portion. Neither have we an inheritance in the son of Jesse. To your tents, Israel. Now see to thy own house, David. And so Israel departed under their tents, and the division of the house of Israel commenced at this point, and Jeroboam took 10 tribes to the north, identifying themselves as Israel, leaving Rehoboam with Judah, Benjamin, and a smattering of Levites called Judah, meaning the Jews, yes, are Israelites, but do not define all Israelites. And that's a point of clarity all of us need to grasp, because that's in your Bible, brother. 4 books are dedicated to listing, recording, chronicling those kings of both Judah, one nation, and Israel, second nation, divided kingdom, of the commonality or the commonwealth of Israel. And those 4 books are 1st and 2nd Kings and 1st and 2nd Chronicles. This is a major shift. It's a major manifestation. And I submit to you, the vast majority of the Christian community today, it goes right over their heads. It goes right over their heads, and consequently miss the connection of the United States of America and its connection to Israel. The very fact of this separation is in similitude to what the United States went through in separating from the United Kingdom, England. A similar story. If you're aware of or familiar with any kind of American history with respect to the fact of taxes and high taxes, tea and paper, and, of course, stamps. The Revolutionary War. The Revolutionary War was, in so many respects, inevitable because it was providential. And why do I say it was providential? Let's go over here to Genesis. Genesis chapter 48. As Ahijah prophesied to Jeroboam, there would be a division in Israel, with Jeroboam taking 10 tribes and a division of Rehoboam with 2. So here, in the beginning of the blessing of Joseph, the tribe of Joseph, by Jacob, Israel, carried the name Israel. His name was changed to Israel, Jacob's was. Here in this scripture and narrative, chapter 48, we see that Joseph took them both, this is verse 13, Ephraim to his right, Manasseh to his left. And so if I were Jacob, I've got Manasseh here on my right, the oldest one, and I've got Ephraim, my younger grandson. I'm playing the role of Jacob in this case. Manasseh's my oldest grandson from Joseph, and Ephraim's my youngest grandson from Joseph. Yet what I do, to the surprise of Joseph, their father, my son, Jacob's son, I flip my hands. The Bible's not quite clear on whether or not God did that. But we know that Jacob thought it and did it. And he blessed the younger with the first blessing and the older with the second blessing. Joseph got miffed. He got angry, says. He said, Father, no. And he grabbed his hands. Jacob said, no, I know what I'm doing, he said. I know what I'm doing. He shall be great too. Look at this here, brethren. In verse 19, the father refused Jacob or Joseph's move on him and said, I know my son. I know it. He also shall become, that's Manasseh, he shall also become a great people or a people, and he also shall be great. But truly, his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his seed shall be a multitude or a fulfillment, a commonwealth, a company of nations. And so we come to understand that predicated on certain evidence and sightings down through world history, that the largest commonwealth of nations to exist in the history of the world was the United Kingdom, consuming 14 approximately million miles, square miles, of planet Earth in its heyday, at its apex, a colonizing people. The statement that the sun never set. Remember that statement? The sun never set on merry old England. But out of this, in verse 20, we continue, he blessed them that day, saying, in you shall Israel bless In thee shall Israel bless, saying, God made you as Ephraim and Manasseh, and he set Ephraim before Manasseh. And Manasseh, we understand through American history, is an outgrowth of the greatest colonizing peoples in the history of the world. And the United States of America came after. The Commonwealth came before. Fulfillment of prophecy, as Ahijah had his prophecy fulfilled with Jeroboam. Brethren, we're living in a very, very blessed country. I'm just introducing this subject to you. I'm going to finish it, God willing, next Sabbath. But let me leave you with this. It's important. We've got roughly now about 10 days, 8 days, to one of the most could-be turning points in the history of this United States of America. And I know I've been talking to a lot of riders in the storm. Because whether we like it or not, the reality that we're in, John referenced it a little bit, things are different. People want to say we got new normals. I even hate that terminology. I want to go back to old normals. I like old normals. I was very comfortable in old normals. I don't want new normals, you know? But the fact of it is, brethren, like it or not, we are in a storm. We are in life-changing circumstances that portend to even become more burdensome if indeed this particular election goes the way of the Marxist globalists. That's just a fact. So, I'm just asking all of us for this week to think strongly about whether or not you are just riders in the storm. Or are you warriors in the storm? Major difference. Next week, we'll make that distinction.